Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. Now, on with our program. This is Mike Consul, your host. Thank you for listening. About 10 days ago, I posted on social media a list of what I call the dozen novels that every man should read. And that's what this episode is about. I'm going to list off those dozen novels, as I did on social media, but I'm going to elaborate on why those particular novels, what's contained within them, why I think men should read them. And at the same time, I obviously, women, these novels are for you as well. But I think these dozen novels contain some elements that, in particular, speak to men, or men can derive some important messages from that maybe even help them fulfill their destiny. Maybe that's an overstatement. I don't know. You be the judge of that. Now, these novels will be ticked off in no particular order, although the first of the novels that I'm about to discuss is my favorite. That would be White Noise by Don DeLillo. That was the 1985 winner of the National Book Award. I learned about Don DeLillo and White Noise. I'd never even heard of Don DeLillo before until 85 when I was reading the New York Times book review. They did a terrific review on the book, spoke, of course, very highly, not only of the book, but of Don DeLillo's writing career. And I was off and running with Don DeLillo at that point. White Noise tells the story of Jack Gladney and his fourth wife, Babette. They have four children who are trying to, and I'll read a little from the dust cover here, navigate the rocky passages of family life to the background babble of brand name consumerism. At the core of the book is what Don DeLillo calls the airborne toxic event. It's actually an industrial accident that unleashes this lethal black chemical cloud that floats over the city. And people have to go on the run. But, you know, at its root, this novel is about the fear of death. And just to flesh this out a little bit more, Jack Gladney is a professor of Hitler studies at the College on the Hill, an esteemed college. It's a nameless college in the town of Blacksmith. And yes, he is a professor of Hitler studies, where he studies Adolf Hitler and his implications throughout time. He lives with this great shame that he doesn't speak the German language, you know, even though there's going to be a conference coming up where actual Germans will be there. And he's trying to learn German. And some of the book takes you into the lessons, his German lessons, where he struggles to actually bend his tongue and form the words of the German language. There's some great scenes in that. Is there something about Don DeLillo and the German people and the German language that comes through really powerfully in this novel? And the dialogue in this book, if you've ever heard somebody say, you should write like people really speak, I always say that's nonsense, because if you ever listen to people speak, it's boring. There's nothing boring about the dialogue in this book. It's hysterically funny. The characters are funny. The dialogue's funny, but not in a punchline sort of way. It's important to say that, because there are people who will read this book, and I know there's people who have read this book and didn't find it comedic. But it's very funny. But you have to see the comedy contained within the actual dialogue and within who these characters are. And the thing that Don DeLillo achieves in this novel, which really, well, one of several things that really distinguish it, is that you feel like it has a little bit of an otherworldly flavor about it. You feel like you're set just a little bit off from normal reality. You're in this different kind of space, a slightly different dimension. It's really powerful stuff. So, men, what is it about? What is it about this book that makes it a male read? You know, death is the ultimate certainty in life. You know, it sits in the back of every human mind. And I would say it's the subliminal root of all of our fears and all of our anxieties. And Jack is riven with anxiety. Babette is riven with anxiety. And what Don DeLillo does is he uses these characters to force readers to confront this fear and this fate in a way that I think enriches our lives and also entertains us. Now, that's not a uniquely male fear. I mean, anxiety, fear, death, that's all female as well as male. But at the same time, Jack Gladney being at the heart of this novel, a male trying to play a leading role in family life, trying to navigate this situation, both his family life, which is quite chaotic, as well as this airborne toxic event and its aftermath, really speaks, I think, to the male animal. Number two, American Tabloid by James Ellroy. This is just a kick-ass cool book. It is, well, one critic said it's like Pulp Fiction, the movie, Pulp Fiction in style and content. I disagree. I think it's a lot better than Pulp Fiction. I liked Pulp Fiction. It was a great movie. But I think American Tabloid is a lot better than that. James Ellroy is known for his short sentences, his fast style. This is the coolest of any of his books. It really is a tremendous read. It's a fast read, but it's not a small book, and it's not a big book, but it's a fast read. And I will tell you this, it's filled with characters who you know, people like Howard Hughes and Jack Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover and Guy Bannister, very much the CIA, the Kennedy assassination, and so on. But it's told in a way that is not a recitation of what you already know about the Kennedy assassination. You could read this book and not really walk away necessarily saying it's about the Kennedy assassination. It's got so many different elements to it. The characters are so vividly drawn, and there is the relationships between the characters is not always good, let me tell you. This novel is full of hardcore and violent men and sexy women. So men, what is about this book? This is a novel that's full of toxic masculinity, and it's a reminder that male chemistry can create these evil instincts within us, that we need to be careful about what that chemistry does and how we allow it to express itself. But this novel is also just full of excitement and framed within some of the, you know, ugliest history of the CIA. Number three is the novel Villages by John Updike. This is his 21st novel. John Updike is a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction. It's my favorite novel of his by far. And it's really a sexy book. It's a sexy novel. You know, John Updike has always had a thing for women, and that thing has always been carnal in nature, which is one of the reasons why feminists have bashed him over the years, him and a lot of other writers. But the thing about John Updike is he writes so seemingly so effortlessly, beautifully and effortlessly. He can frustrate a writer because you see the beauty of his language, and there's just a sense that it's so easy for him, that the Supreme Being has imbued him with this special gift for writing that we don't possess. And therein lies the frustration. Now, I know that John Updike has been accused of writing beautifully about nothing. That's not the case with Villages. Okay, I think that's a valid criticism of John Updike, I think, but it's not a valid criticism of this book. I've heard nobody say this about this book. He tells a story of a man named Owen McKenzie, and he takes him from childhood right through really the end of his life. And one of the things John Updike does in this book, which surprised me, is that he writes about the computer revolution. Now, he does so in a way that's entertaining. You might think the computer revolution, that sounds boring. It's not boring at all. And it's only an element of the book. Owen McKenzie goes into technology. He becomes a computer scientist. He works for technology companies. He starts a technology company or two of his own. And he's very drawn to women. And so are the other male characters in this book. Terrific writing. A lot of turning points. And the relationship between Owen and his wives, he's, has more than one wife and other women, is exhilarating, honestly. So men, consider this a book about professionalism, professional desire and achievement, and carnal ambitions. Number four, The Human Stain by Philip Roth. Now, Philip Roth won the Pulitzer Prize for the novel he wrote after this one, which was American Pastoral. But The Human Stain is probably my favorite Philip Roth book. At the center of this book is a college professor named Coleman Silk. He's a light-skinned black man who has passed himself off as a Jewish person his entire life, basically his entire adult life, and he renounced his own family to do this. He didn't want anything to do with his family. He cut them off, probably because he never wanted the secret to come out. But he finds himself at the head of an English department, years at the head of an English department. And you know how you make enemies along the way if you're involved as a, certainly at the head of a particular college within a university. But what happens with Coleman Silk is that, and I'm not giving really the novel away by saying this, is that there's a couple students who have never shown up for class for several weeks into the course. And he asks the students, does anybody know these people? Are they people or spooks? Well, it just so happened that they were both black. And that was, of course, taken as a racist remark when he didn't even know they were black. And the students don't know that Coleman Silk is not Jewish. He's actually African-American. So what happens is, you can imagine, the very much consistent with today and cancel culture and wokeism and all of that stuff, he is then basically dethroned. He ends up getting involved with a college janitor who's basically an illiterate 34-year-old woman who has a history of being victimized by men. You can judge for yourself whether you think she's being victimized by Coleman Silk. And during this book, especially early on, there's allusions made to the Clinton administration, a Monica Lewinsky scandal. And, you know, one of the novel's central plot lines involves, you know, accusations of racism and misogyny. One of the things Philip Roth does in this book, which I really enjoyed, is that you think you understand a character because that character has been rendered, self-rendered in some cases, but when he switches to other characters later in the book, you start to see a different perspective, just like real life, where somebody may say things about themselves or a situation, but if you talk to somebody who knows them, they've got a really different take on what that person's all about. So this novel is revelatory all the way through to the end. It's part of the Zuckerman, Nathan Zuckerman novels that Philip Roth wrote. And it's a truly terrific story. It's a novel for our times. So men, this is where we confront false allegations of racism and misogyny. Very serious issues that I'm in no way minimizing, but there is such a thing as false allegations. Sometimes they're malicious, but sometimes, oftentimes, I think they're simply a consequence of misunderstandings. Certainly in this case, there's a misunderstanding there. And what does Coleman Silk do in a situation like that when he spent his whole life pretending to be something that he was not, even though that something, if he would reveal it, would set him free? Novel number five, East of Eden, by the great Nobel Prize winner, John Steinbeck. Now, Steinbeck considered this book to be his magnum opus. He had said, there's a quotation from him that he said about East of Eden, that it has everything in it I have been able to learn about my craft or profession in all these years. And then later he said, he was quoted as saying, I think everything else I've written has been, in a sense, practice for this. That would include The Grapes of Wrath, which he was so famous for. This book is is considered a masterpiece by many people. It was first published in 1952. It's got a cast of characters that operate mainly in the farmlands of California's Salinas Valley near the Monterey Peninsula. And it's a sprawling novel. It's a big book. It's a big book, but don't let that intimidate you. And it's very much about the destiny of two different families, the Trasks and the Hamiltons, whose generations basically helplessly reenact the fall of Adam and Eve and the poisonous rivalry between Cain and Abel. So it's a family saga in a modern, 1952 retelling of the book of Genesis. And it's considered John Steinbeck's most ambitious novel. The thing about John Steinbeck is he's got a writing style. He's got phrasing. He writes beautifully, of course, but he's got phrasing that is just unique to him. The book is filled with phrases and interactions that you just don't read in other novels. So it's a really distinctive novel in that way, that distinctive language that John Steinbeck brought to the literary world. So, men, again, this is a big book of male relationships with one another and with women. Male bonding, males falling out with one another, bonding with one another. It's a book about how pride and misunderstandings can complicate or even ruin our lives. And it's all wrapped in a Bible-esque style of storytelling. Powerful stuff. Number 6, from another Nobel Prize winner, The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. Again, another recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature. This is the polar opposite, in some ways, of East of Eden. East of Eden is a big book. The Old Man and the Sea is a small novel. In fact, it probably should have been called a novella. It's only 27,000 words in length. And, well, John Steinbeck's East of Eden is rich in a panoply of characters. The Old Man and the Sea has really just a few characters. And the central character is an old Cuban fisherman who has gone for 84 days without making a catch. And he goes back out to sea. It's just him on the sea in his skiff. And the sense of isolation you feel out there with him as he tries to find his luck again in catching fish. I mean, 84 days without a catch. He ends up during this novel, catching a monster-sized marlin on that 85th day. And it's a struggle, and he needs to bring that fish in. And it's a contest of wills. It's a contest in overcoming fear and courage in the face of danger. So Ernest Hemingway said about the story, man is not meant for defeat. A man can be destroyed but not defeated. Interesting perspective. So men, the isolation, the loneliness, the fear that we feel when we think we've lost our ability to adequately perform what's necessary for our livelihoods, and the relentlessness of the human spirit, even for an old Cuban fisherman, is very much what this book is about. It's a very spare novel. There's the richness of East of Eden juxtaposed with The Old Man and the Sea, which is a very spare novel, very classic Ernest Hemingway, beautifully written, and you go for that boat ride, and you fight that fish with that old man. Great piece of work by one of America's greatest writers. Number 7 is The Bonfire of the Vanities. This is a towering novel about high finance in Manhattan. The main character is an investment banker. His name is Sherman McCoy. Life is mostly good, but you know, he's making a ton of money and yet he's spending a ton of money. It was that era, and I think that era it has extended even to today, where people, even though they make a lot of money, they've got to have all the trappings of that success, and they end up creating a monthly financial nut that's hard to meet. So the struggle is on to try to keep up. In the meantime, he's having an affair with a woman named Maria, a Southern woman named Maria. He goes to pick her up at the airport. He accidentally takes the wrong exit. He's actually forced to because of traffic, and he's not paying enough attention to that he's in the wrong lane. So he's forced to take an exit that takes him to the Bronx. And what a great passage that is, that section of the novel where he is trying to find his way out of the Bronx and is seeing what is a threatening environment all around him. And sure enough, they end up running across a young black man with apparently some bad intentions. They take off from the scene in his, I forget if it's a Mercedes or a BMW. And I believe what happens is he fishtails, he hits the young man who goes down. They get out of there. They never call the police about what's happened because he can't explain. He doesn't want to have to explain that he's with a woman other than his wife and so on. And a few days later, they find out that the young black man had to be taken to the hospital and that he died there. And of course, the big issue there for Sherman McCoy is that I don't want to be held responsible for this thing. It was an accident. I didn't try to hit him, and so on and so forth. Well, black activists get involved in this guy's death. The police are investigating, and lo and behold, they run across Sherman, largely because of his own inability to keep his cool. So basically, and all of this is told in Tom Wolfe's electric prose. Basically, his charmed life turns into kind of a nightmare. So men, the operative word here with this novel is vanity, straight out of the book's title, male vanity at that, and how quickly a seemingly, you know, successful and indomitable life can turn into a bonfire. In this case, because Sherman McCoy finds himself in the clutches of the New York City court and prison systems, as well as the target, again, of black activists who see the death of this young black man as another case of a black male being treated, the death of an American black male being treated frivolously. And as I said, Tom Wolfe's prose, as always, are absolutely electric. Number 8 is The End of the Affair by the great British author Graham Greene. This is a 1951 novel written right around the same time as East of Eden. It's set in London during and just after World War II. And the novel really examines the obsessions, jealousy, and discernments that take place within a relationship between a few central characters. A writer named Bendrix, Sarah Miles, and her husband, who's a civil servant. His name is Henry Miles. Well, Maurice Bendrix and Sarah Miles end up in the love affair. They fall in love quickly, and he soon realizes that the affair is going to end just as quickly as it began. The relationship suffers from his overt and admitted jealousy. He's frustrated by her refusal to divorce Henry and spend the rest of her life with him. And Henry's he's a affable guy, but a boring husband. A bomb blast damages Bendrix's flat as he and Sarah are together. He is nearly killed after this. You know, Sarah breaks off the affair with no apparent explanation. This is Graham Greene at his best, a terrific writer and storyteller. And for men, this is a story of male passion and jealousy and indiscretion, all the things that we men are prone to. And the story is just, again, artfully rendered by one of Britain's greatest 20th century novelists, Graham Greene. Number nine is The Wife by Meg Wolitzer. She's the only woman on this list. And The Wife tells the tale of a warped version of the adage that behind every successful man is a good woman. We're talking about Joseph Castleman and his wife, Joan Castleman. The book starts where they're on a plane headed for Helsinki, Finland, where Joseph Castleman is supposed to receive a prestigious literary prize, which is akin to the Nobel Prize. And on that flight, Joan has already made up her mind that her marriage is dead and that she's going to divorce Joseph. But she's not going to spoil the bestowing of this award on him. She wants to let that get past them before she says, I'm done with this. And Meg Wolitzer is such a skilled writer. I feel like it took a woman to write this story about men and how badly they can behave within a marriage. And Meg Wolitzer describes her husband. Now, the wife is the narrator in this novel. But she describes her husband, and I'm quoting straight out of the novel here, and I quote, "It was difficult to disturb this man. He had everything he could ever possibly need. He was Joseph Castleman, one of those men who own the world. You know the type I mean, those who are advertisements for themselves, those sleepwalking giants roaming the earth and knocking over other men, women, furniture, villages. Why should they care? They own everything, the seas and the mountains, the quivering volcanoes, the ruffling rivers," end quote. A great summation of Joseph Castleman, a self-absorbed man who is all about himself. And this novel, so men, what do you take away from this novel? This novel is the embodiment of the narcissistic husband who sees his wife as little more than an adjunct to his celebrated life, or even not so celebrated life. We all know men like this, but I don't think they've ever been illustrated more forcefully than Meg Wolitzer has done with Joseph Castleman in this novel. And again, I think it took a woman to tell this story as a kick right in the crotch. Number 10. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency by Douglas Adams. This is just such a joyous book. You know, sometimes guys just want to have fun, and this novel is sheer joy. And Dirk Gently, there's no bones about it. This is a comedic novel. It's very funny. Douglas Adams, sadly, who died at only age, 50 or 55. Who knows what he would have been turning out if he had lived. But this novel is sheer joy. It's infused with this sense that even incompetent men often overestimate their skills and professionalism. And yet, alas, they come out winning in the end. So never discount the power of overconfidence and luck. We all know men who they're not really very good. They think they're way better than they are, and somehow they've succeeded despite all that. It's just that they have that kind of pluck that they're able to do it. So Douglas Adams just writes with such, he's one of the funniest novelists we've ever had. And by the way, if you are good with audio, I would urge you to consider the audio version of this book, which is read by Douglas Adams himself, and he reads with tremendous vigor and inflection and with all the comedic impact that we've come to expect from the Brits, from the British, but also from Douglas Adams. And there's something about an author reading this book. He reads so fast. And again, with such intent, he knows exactly when what he wanted to say and how he wanted to say it when he was writing those words. So when he reads it, it's there in a way that nobody else could have done. Number 11, Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas by Tom Robbins. Now, this is another hysterically funny book. Tom Robbins, if you know Tom Robbins, Another Roadside Attraction, Only Cowgirls Get the Blues, Jitterbug Perfume, he's always a funny writer. Finn, I'm gonna crib here from another critic who talked about it being a phantasmagoric novel, thinking in terms of, you know, passing images, and that's very much the way Tom Robbins writes. It's always super colorful. It's always energetic. And the critics didn't all like this book. I loved it. I think it's his best. And I loved Another Roadside Attraction, but I think this is his best. Think in terms of a crashing stock market, a money-obsessed Seattle stockbroker, a man with a pet monkey, a tall, dark stranger who returns from Africa with a cure for colon cancer, a 300-pound psychic. So you get the picture. This plot is a literary stew, along with dashes of global issues such as environmental degradation and economic volatility, AIDS, the violence between the rich and the poor. But this pot of literary stew is laced with Tom Robbins' usual and unusual psychedelic and sexual language that we've come to expect from this author. So, man, the book is filled with the shiny objects that tend to distract us and the foolish things that we tend to do when under financial stress or sexual duress. Number 12 is Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney. One of the things you recognize right away with this book, which was the first time I'd ever read anything like it, is that he writes in second person, not in first person, not in third person, not in the I, not in the he or the, you know, Joe Blow mode, but second person, as in you do this, you know, you pick her up at the curb. She says such and such to you. You respond with such and such. It has a whole different flavor to it, just that second person perspective alone. But this is a great city novel. It's based in New York. When it was published in 1984, Jay McInerney became a literary sensation. And he was heralded as the voice of a generation, of his generation. So a young man is working for, the main character is working for a New York magazine at in the Department of Factual Verification, basically fact-checking. And the novel follows him through really a compact period of time. He's living in Manhattan. He goes to nightclubs. He goes to fashion shows. He's in the editorial offices. He attends loft parties. But his professional life is not going well. And, as he allows errors to slip into the magazine, errors that he's supposed to be stamping out, his personal life's not going well either. His wife, Amanda, a fashion model, has left him. One account of this novel says, with nothing but goodwill, controlled substances, and wit to sustain him, he runs until he reaches his reckoning point where he is forced to acknowledge loss and possibly to rediscover his better instincts. This remarkable novel of youth in New York remains one of the most beloved, imitated, and iconic novels in America. So guys, what will you get from this? You must get the idea at this point. Who among us has not been young and insecure about our professional and romantic prospects? So Bright Lights, Big City will resonate with you, resonate with those anxieties and bring back shades of our youth and reward us. Reward us with high literary entertainment. It's a very entertaining book. It's a book that moves quickly, not a big book. So this book made a big impact on me back when I was in my 20s, and I trust it will make a big impact on you as well. So there you have it. The dozen novels that every man should read. Thank you for listening. For Novelist Spotlight, I'm Mike Consell.